This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Marylhurst.edu/KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News.
Activists on both sides of the fluoride debate made their presence known in Portland today.
A new report reveals details about the poverty rate of children in Oregon.
Residents in Northeast Portland are mobilizing to protest the development of a large apartment building. Good evening, this is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 23rd, 2013. I'm Ren Green.
And I'm Alex Ford. Residents of Portland's Beaumont-Wilshire neighborhood are protesting the location of a planned four-story, 50-unit apartment block on Northeast Fremont Street. The organization Beaumont-Wilshire Neighbors for Responsible Growth announced earlier this month that it will appeal the project's permit with the Oregon Land Use Board of Appeals, or LUBA. For more, KBOO's Sam Bowman spoke with Carol Lauer, a member of the neighborhood group.
Okay. How long have you been having an issue with this proposed project?
We learned about the project last June, and there was a neighborhood association meeting, an open meeting for the entire community, and then there was another committee that was formed and looked at what the possibilities were, that we could throw out some options to the developer. But then that committee did its work, and then finally just a smaller group, people that live primarily on Northeast 45th between Fremont and Beach, got together, and we decided that we would try to keep the pressure on, try to figure out if there were things that we could do to make people a little bit more comfortable with the upcoming project. So
okay.
It's pushing close to 9-10 months that we've been really involved.
And so what are your primary problems with the project?
Well, it would have been nice had the neighborhood been kind of notified in advance so that we could have been a little bit better prepared. We learned about it via the grapevine, and then we did have the neighborhood open meeting for the whole neighborhood. It's going to be a four-story building. There are no other four-story buildings on Fremont, not in the close proximity. It's going to have 50 units in it. And it's going to have no off-street parking. But parking aside, there are other issues. There are issues of the fact that it's on Fremont Street, and Fremont Street is heavily traveled as it is, and it's not going to get any wider, and it's supposed to be an emergency route. And the lack of regular bus service, transportation, and the added parking, those are all issues.
How would you say your experience has been with the city and state officials so far? Have they been open from the beginning with you?
I wouldn't go so far as to say that, because the developer took advantage of antiquated code requirements or lack thereof, and, you know, a 1980s Portland plan that allowed them to build on the coded CS coding in this area without having any off-street parking. So he stayed within the limits of the law, and, you know, and so we don't know what other strings that he might have been able to pull, and, you know, it's very difficult to find those things out. So, you know, that's about it. We have gone to the city council, and they listened politely, and they did make some changes in the parking recommendation, but the building is under construction. So in mid-February, they demolished the buildings that were there. They are at present pouring concrete, et cetera. So it's definitely underway.
You're pursuing a process with the Land Use Board of Appeals?
Yes. We're going to try to see if there's any way that we could get the Land Use Board to find a loophole for us that would prevent him from building this, which I'm going to call it a monstrosity, a four-story monstrosity, because it's just going to be a big box in the middle of a block, and we've learned that the east and west ends of the building will not be allowed by city code to have any kind of windows in them, so they're just going to be these like walls, four-story walls that just really aren't in keeping with the neighborhood. We had proposed to the gentleman, Mr. Remmers, that he at least accommodate the neighborhood by making it only three stories tall, which would be a bit more in keeping with the community, but he was not open to that. We have not had much positive interaction with him.
Do you have any relation to the Richmond case? I think they were victorious.
We are aware of the Richmond case and the Kearns case. We know that the Richmond case went to LUBA, that LUBA found a reason to shut down the permit, which they did, and then the permit had to be reissued. And bottom line, after a certain period of time, they were allowed to begin building again, with minimal changes in the original plan. You know, we can only try to be optimistic, but we also understand that, it may not come in our direction.
For KABU Community Radio, this is Sam Bowman speaking with Carol Lauer of the Beaumont-Wilshire Neighbors for Responsible Development.
Children First for Oregon, a Portland-based nonprofit, recently released their 2012 County Data Book, which compiles information related to child health and welfare and family financing. The book reveals that in 2011, about 44% of Oregon children were low income and about 23% were living in poverty. Both numbers represent an increase from the previous 2 years. Matt Quince of Children First attributes the rise partly to the shaky status of working families, for whom a furlough or reduction in weekly hours could put them in the low income bracket overnight. Some other trends indicated by the data book include the disproportionate poverty of rural areas over urban ones, the percentage of uninsured children continues to fall, and the percentage of students proficient in grade school math and science has declined significantly from 2009 to 2011.
State legislators are considering a bill that would add $5 to real estate recording fees that will help returning veterans find and stay in their homes. In collaboration with the Oregon News Service, KABU's Bill Riley has more.
Just $5 for Oregon's homeless veterans. It's an offer being examined in a legislative committee hearing today, Monday. The bill, House Bill 2417, would add $5 to the real estate recording fee, with the money going to help veterans with emergency housing, affordable housing, and home ownership. Allison Perry at Central Oregon Veterans Outreach in Bend says so many young vets are coming home to an economy still in distress, and there are estimates that up to 7,000 veterans in Oregon are homeless.
And they're struggling with so much in terms of integrating their combat experiences that it's harder for them to work. So to meet that basic need of housing can make a huge difference for someone.
The Housing Alliance reports that when veterans do find work, most of the kinds of jobs available don't pay enough to afford housing. It's expected the increase would generate about $6 million through 2015. Gerald Pigott is a case manager at Northwest Human Services who spends 2 days a week in the brush and forests looking for veterans living in tents. He finds that when they don't have a roof over their heads, they can't concentrate on anything else.
By stabilizing housing, then they can move forward because that safety concern isn't there. So now they can start focusing on jobs and all that.
Pigott says most of the homeless veterans he encounters are from Iraq and Afghanistan, although homelessness is also persistent among older vets. In collaboration with the Oregon News Service, this is Bill Riley with KBOO News.
Superintendent of Portland Schools Carol Smith released her public schools budget last week. It's about $20 million more than last year's budget and makes strategic investments in several problem areas while adding 7 full-time jobs. It also includes continued cuts, especially at schools affected by falling enrollment. Some teachers have begun to push for greater investment in new high school teachers. A deal with the teachers' union set a maximum of 7 classes per student per term out of 8 periods in the school day. However, even if every student took those 7 classes, there wouldn't be enough teachers to cover them all. As it stands, students on average fill about 6.5 class periods out of 8. 2-hour stretches of free time in the middle of the school day are not unheard of. It is estimated that 26.5 positions would be required to fill the gap, amounting to $2.6 million. Superintendent Smith says that the $466 million budget does not have room for reinvestment projects, but teachers maintain that fixing the holes in the schedule is a crucial step in fixing Portland's public schools.
Campaigns working to influence the debate on adding fluoride to the city's drinking water held visibility actions today. Next month, voters will decide on Measure 26-151, which would require the city to add fluoride to Portland's drinking water by March 2014. KBOO's Rebecca Ney has more.
Fluoride opponents gathered in downtown Portland today to highlight data that shows declining tooth decay rates in Oregon. Kim Kaminsky from Clean Water Portland explains.
We just got new data released by the Oregon Health Authority showing that Oregon has experienced nearly 20% decline in cavity rates, and Portland has experienced nearly a 10% decrease. So this concept that we have a dental crisis, I think that we really need to take a look at the numbers. That data also shows that we have one of the lowest cavity rates in the country, and that's without fluoridation.
The preliminary data comes from the 2007 Oregon Smile Survey. Full details from the survey have yet to be released. The coalition Healthy Kids, Healthy Portland gathered approximately 100 fluoride supporters in North Portland today, offering one-on-one interviews with families impacted by what they call the dental health crisis. Raquel Bornanesque, a coalition member from Upstream Public Health, says that tooth decay is a problem that needs to be dealt with.
I mean, right now, we know from the complete report that was put out several years ago that 1 in 5 children right now in Portland sitting in a classroom are suffering from untreated tooth decay. And, you know, we find that absolutely unacceptable. We know that Portland kids suffer from 40% more untreated decay as compared to Seattle that fluoridates their water and has been since 1970.
While Bornanesque argues that adding fluoride to Portland's drinking water is necessary to address dental health concerns, Kaminsky says there are better options.
We have programs in place that provide low-income children with insurance through the Oregon Health Plan. We have dental sealant programs. We have programs in the schools. We have low-income dental clinics. You know, compared to Seattle, Washington has 111, I believe, low-income dental clinics, whereas in Portland we have 10.
While Raquel Bornanesque conceded that adding additional dental clinics in the Portland area is needed, she also says they have their work cut out for them here compared to Seattle residents who are drinking fluoridated water.
Well, the problem is, you know, I was just speaking with the medical director of Outside In and dentist at Medical Teams International, and they are really seeing the front lines of the dental health crisis. They are treating in free clinics in Portland, but what they say is they're not doing preventative things like cleaning. They're actually doing extractions and having to do really serious procedures because Portland's teeth are such a mess.
Kim Kaminsky also drew comparisons between Portland and cities with fluoride in their water supply, but came to a different conclusion.
You know, when you look across the country, most of the country is fluoridated, and that's pretty much why they're trying to target Portland, because we're the largest major city that remains unfluoridated. And we look at cities like Detroit and Boston and Chicago, and we are seeing decay rates
that are much larger than the decay rates that we're seeing here, you know, and they've been fluoridated for decades.
With the May 21st ballot deadline on the horizon, the rhetoric and debate around this issue will continue to grow. With KBOO News, this is Rebecca Ney.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Out Loud at 6. Tonight's show welcomes back the organizers of the Portland Queer Documentary Film Festival, which is slated to begin on May 17th. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is sunny with a high near 75.
It's 5:19, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
I like the word gobsmacked because it sounds like what it means, something completely astonishing, so unbelievable that it smacks you. For example, on April 3rd, ExxonMobil was scrambling to cope with thousands of barrels of tar sands oil oozing out of a ruptured pipeline in the town of Mayflower, Arkansas. The spreading toxic contamination from the oil giant's pipeline was awful, but hardly surprising, given Exxon's long record of reckless disregard for our environment, people, and communities. So, the gobsmacking news of April 3rd was not that America's most profitable corporation had yet another spewing disaster on its hands, but that something called the National Safety Council awarded its Green Cross for Safety medal that very day to, guess who? The contaminator of Mayflower. Presenting the award during an event in Houston, NSC's president declared with a straight face, "It is evident that ExxonMobil is committed to excellence in safety, security, health, and environmental performance." Good grief! While Mayflower was covered in Exxon oil, Exxon was being covered with environmental praise. It was like giving a bird protection award to a smiling cat with feathers still stuck in its whiskers. What exactly is the National Safety Council? An industry front. In fact, the green in the Green Cross Award could refer to the color of money, for both the Exxon Corporation and its foundation were top donors to NSC last year. Indeed, the Oil Corporation has not one but two representatives on NSC's board of directors, making Exxon the awarder as well as the awardee of the Green Cross. Not to single it out, past awardee Dow Chemical is also a board member. This is Jim Hightower saying, apparently, NSC's paramount safety concern is for the PR image of its corporate funders.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Hundreds of building trades union leaders and members in Washington for the Building Trades 2013 National Legislative Conference will rally today in support of the Keystone XL pipeline project. The building trades unions say they want a renewed focus and energy on America's continuing jobs crisis, and they say that effort can begin by approving the Keystone XL pipeline. Utility workers President Michael Langford says America could create a serious 21st century greening of our economy through smart, substantial investments in infrastructure upgrades and replacement.
We lose methane gas from natural gas from leaking pipes into the air, which equates to 120 million automobiles. And the electrical grid voltage and line loss alone is phenomenal. And so just by improving all these, to me, will help green the economy, but also help our members because, I mean, these are all good paying jobs. And not only our members, but building trades and others.
Langford says the U.S. is falling behind other nations in the quality and condition of our infrastructure, and he says rebuilding U.S. infrastructure using state-of-the-art green technology to cope with the impact of climate change is essential. But he says it's being held back by Wall Street's profits obsession.
Post Sandy, it's crazy to go back up there and rebuild a system just like it was. So it's a system, the electric, we're working off a 19th century system. We need to upgrade it, and there's ways to upgrade it. There's been technological advancements that Europe and Asia's using. We're just not doing it because it's all about Wall Street and profits.
More than 100 striking yellow checker star transportation taxi drivers took a bus from Las Vegas to a demonstration at the state capitol at Carson City, Nevada, Tuesday. The taxi drivers were there to demonstrate against the assembly's failure to bring Assembly Bill 329 to a vote. That bill would prohibit long hauling, running up the meter on passengers by traveling longer than necessary. The striking Las Vegas taxi drivers are members of ITPEU, OPEIU. More than 700 drivers have been on strike against Yellow Checker Star since March 3rd. Issues include wages and compensation and long hours with no overtime pay. Many drivers were making below minimum wage until a complaint was filed and a settlement was reached requiring Yellow Checker Star to pay more than $387,000 in back wages. The union also alleges unfair labor practices by Yellow Checker Star. Union workers united with other concerned Boston citizens to protect the funeral service of a Boston Marathon victim from a small Kansas religious cult known for shocking and offensive funeral protests. The Teamsters said their members and others served as human shields at the funeral of Crystal Campbell on Monday. The hate group didn't show up. Sean O'Brien, president of Teamsters Local 25, says he's committed to making certain that loved ones of the bombing victims can grieve in peace.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, April 23rd, 2013. Israeli soldiers uproot olive trees in southern West Bank and settlers attack villagers in central West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. The Israeli army uprooted on Tuesday 1,600 olive trees owned by Palestinian farmers from the villages of Susia and Halhul near the southern West Bank city of Hebron. According to residents, soldiers stormed the two villages since the early hours of Tuesday morning and started to uproot young olive trees owned by 11 families. Local activists say farmers have lost their livelihood due to the army attack today. Also on Tuesday, the Israeli army demolished 15 homes and barns owned by Palestinians in the Jordan Valley. Local activists told media that troops and bulldozers stormed Wadi al-Malih area in the Jordan Valley and demolished 4 homes and 11 barns. The residents say the army escalated the demolition campaign in the Jordan Valley against Palestinian farmers since the start of this year. Since January, 80 homes and barns, along with other structures owned by Palestinian farmers, were destroyed by the Israeli army in the Jordan Valley. In central West Bank, Israeli settlers burned on Tuesday at least a dozen cars owned by villagers of Deir Jarir near Ramallah city. Villagers told local media that armed settlers attacked their village in the early hours of today's morning and used homemade bombs to set some cars on fire, then left under the protection of the Israeli military. Elsewhere, Israeli troops invaded the northern West Bank city of Nablus on Tuesday at dawn, searched homes, and then arrested 3 men. Local sources reported that soldiers ransacked at least 10 homes in the city before taking the men away. The army gave no reason for the arrest. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, April 23rd news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hassan Kassis and me, Hassan Barnoura.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Bill Riley and Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Sequoia Wright. The KABU Interim Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Rebecca Ney. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K264AA Corvallis, 100.7 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Ren Green.
And I'm Alex Ward. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Wednesday morning talk radio, Lisa Loving speaks with Marty Pivetto and Love Canal activist Lois Gibbs about the fight against toxic pollution in our neighborhoods. At 9 on Political Perspectives, host Lisa Loving interviews author and radio show host Tom Hartman about the shift of power to corporations and the loss of power for the people who form the cornerstone of democracy. Tom Hartman speaks at the First Unitarian Church in Portland on Friday, April 26th at 7 p.m. At 9:30, Cindy Folkers and Mary Olson speak on post-Fukushima food monitoring and gender matters in the atomic age. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on the Recovery Zone, the topic is rethinking money while taking a look at Bitcoin. Host Stephanie Potter speaks with local Bitcoin and alternative currency experts who are rethinking the concept of money. Join the discussion. Thanks, KABU members, for your generous support. If you are not a KABU member, you can become one by going to kabu.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
Stay tuned now for more national and international news from the worker-run collective at Free Speech Radio News. Good night, Alex.
Good night, Ren.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, April 23rd, 2013. In Mountain View, California, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, federal officials mirandize Boston Marathon bombing suspect Johar Tsarnaev will examine the charges against him and the government's historical use of the label terrorist. Palestinian prisoner Samir Essawi ends his hunger strike after reaching a deal with the Israeli military. And as the U.S. continues to withhold recognition of Venezuela's election results, FSRN speaks to election monitors who said results were fair, transparent, and well-organized. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. The EPA says that the U.S. State Department has not sufficiently evaluated the potential environmental impact of the Keystone XL pipeline project. In a letter sent to the State Department yesterday, the Environmental Protection Agency critiqued the very basis of the department's environmental impact analysis. They say the assumption that the same amount of tar sands crude will move to market with or without the pipeline is flawed. The EPA also says the State Department did not use current energy economic modeling. And according to the agency, because the pipeline could carry much more diluted bitumen than rail could transport, the net greenhouse gas emissions could be far higher than the State Department estimate. The EPA says the State Department doesn't fully explore alternative routes or adequately address possible spills. The State Department is due to finalize the assessment in June. The U.S. Ambassador to Pakistan, Richard Olson, congratulated the country today on the democratic process in advance of elections set for early May. Yet in the run-up to the poll, there's been much political violence in Pakistan. Umar Farooq reports from Lahore on dozens of people who died in the past week.
On Sunday, suspected Taliban militants killed two members of the Awami National Party, a secular party that has called for more military action against the group. The party was also targeted last week when a suicide bomber killed 19 people in Peshawar. Several other people were killed in separate attacks against members of the ruling Pakistan People's Party and the Mutahida Qaumi Movement. In Balochistan, separatist groups have called for a boycott of the elections. On Sunday, a grenade was thrown at a meeting of several hundred members of the National Party in Turbat. And last week, an attack on a candidate of the Pakistan Muslim League killed four. The May 11th elections will be the first time one civilian government in Pakistan has transferred power to another. Umar Farooq, FSRN, Lahore.
Tens of thousands of Sunni Muslims have regularly protested in northern Iraq for months, calling for an end to the de-Ba'athification program and a repeal of what they see as a repressive counterterrorism law. Today, Iraqi troops stormed a demonstration and deadly violence followed. Felix Gaitka has more.
Iraqi security forces raided a Sunni anti-government protest camp near Kirkuk on Tuesday morning. Clashes ensued and dozens of people died. There are conflicting reports of the number of casualties. But Reuters said at least 28 people were killed, six of them government troops, and more than 70 were wounded. A gun battle ensued between security forces, backed by a helicopter, and protesters. Military officials say they entered the camp to make arrests related to an attack on a nearby checkpoint last Friday, saying militant fighters were hiding among the protesters. The shooting, which took place in Hawija, 240 kilometers north of Baghdad, has increased Sunni anger against the Shia-led government. After news of the morning's raid spread, armed groups tried to storm army posts in nearby towns of Rashad and Riyadh. With Gayatri Parameshwara,